Okay, good afternoon, everybody. And I'd just like to welcome those of you who arrived late last night and this morning. Very good to have you with us. I think that's all I need to say by way of preamble. We'll just get on with it. Oh, now, when the bardo of the moment of death upon me is dawning, abandoning attraction and craving and weakness for all worldly things, may I be undistracted in the space of the bright, enlightening teachings. May I transfer awareness into the vast expanse of unborn space. The hour has come to part with this body composed of flesh and blood. May I know the body to be impermanent and illusory. So these are very weighty, very serious, somber words are taken from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, from the Bardo Todol, the great liberation through hearing in the Bardo, in the intermediate state. They're taken from what are known as the root verses of the six Bardos, verses which encapsulate the very essence of the teachings found in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Those who practice the teachings associated with the Tibetan Book of the Dead early on in their training memorize these verses, and they regularly repeat them and recite them to themselves, and indeed some members of our order do this practice as well. We're going to be doing this throughout the retreat. And these verses are memorized in order to generate awareness so that you can practice in the various bardos. This particular verse is an aid to generating awareness in the bardo of the moment of death. The moment of death is regarded as a space in which enlightenment itself can be attained. And this verse is showing the teaching, the practice, that will bring this about. Death, according to the teachings of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is seen as an incredible opportunity, a moment of extraordinary potentiality. Yes, it's the end of the physical body. Yes, it's a very difficult, a very frightening time for most people. But also it's an opening up to amazing possibility. And I'll look into that more closely a little later on. But before that, I want to provide some orientation. I want, first of all, to place the Tibetan Book of the Dead into some sort of context, some sort of historical context, a Tibetan context and a Buddhist context. Then I want to look in more depth at the meaning of the word bardo. That will lead, quite naturally, into a discussion of death and life, and maybe other things as well. So what we call the Tibetan Book of the Dead, that's not its traditional name, is in fact a whole cycle of texts, of Tibetan texts. Tibetan texts take of the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. Nyingma means the ancients. So Nyingma Pa are the school of the ancients, the school of the old ones, because they're followers of what is known as the first diffusion of the Dharma in Tibet, which occurred in the 8th century. And in particular, the Nyingma are the followers of the great Guru Padmasambhava, Guru Rinpoche. There's a painting of Guru Rinpoche just there. That incredible figure who was central to the introduction of Buddhism into Tibet in the 8th century. He himself came from Udayana, known in Tibetan as Urgyen, in the far northwest of the Indian subcontinent, probably an area that's now part of Pakistan. He was a great teacher, a great communicator, a master of all aspects of the Dharma, especially a master of tantric, Vajrayana, yogic and ritual practice. And for the Nyingma, Padmasambhava is the central presiding genius. He is still, even now, a living spiritual force If you go into Nyingma Gompas, Nyingma temples, it will be full of images and tankers of Guru Rinpoche Padmasambhava. He is at the centre of visualisation practice, sadhanas, courses of spiritual practice and training. You cannot overestimate his presence for the Nyingma school and probably for Tibetan Buddhists generally. And he's very important within the Western Buddhist order as well. Sangharakshita himself, his teachers were Nyingma teachers, and he was called by one of his teachers Urgyen Sangharakshita, Urgyen being the land where Padmasambhava comes from. So we've got this strong connection within the FWBO with Padmasambhava. In fact, Padmaloka is one of the names of Padmasambhava's pure land, as it's called, the realm of the lotus. One of the traditions the Nyingma follow regarding Padmasambhava is that during his time in Tibet, he didn't just teach and inspire and instruct the people of that time, of the 8th century Tibet. He also hid away many teachings for future generations. He saw that there were teachings that the people were not ready for at that time. He saw that there were going to be teachings that would be needed for men and women in the future. So he hid things away, texts, images, ritual objects and so on, which were found by later generations. Actually, this tradition is more complex even than that. The tradition goes that what actually happened was that Padmasambhava transmitted particular teachings to his disciples directly, transmitted them directly, wordlessly, mind to mind. Later on, that disciple was reborn. He takes up the practices of the Dharma, a particular sequence of events unfolds. He has a dream, a vision, which directs him to a particular place, a mountain peak, a cave, or a dilapidated temple with an image in it. And there he would find ritual objects or mysterious yellow scrolls with arcane script written on these yellow scrolls. Just a few lines. And the events, the objects, the scrolls awaken the depths of his mind, awaken the deep memory of the mind-to-mind transmission that took place back in the 8th century with Padmasambhava. The teaching erupts in the consciousness of this latter-day disciple. It erupts, it unfolds, the disciple writes it out, it becomes text, it becomes literature, it becomes teaching, it becomes practice, which the teacher then transmits to his disciples. Now these texts, these found texts, are known as terma, which literally means that which is taken out, if you like, treasure texts. They're regarded as hidden treasures, taken out, and the finder, the revealer, is known as the tertön, he who takes out, or treasure finder. So the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the cycle of texts we call the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is one of these terma. Now, you may well smile at all this. It sounds really rather far-fetched and a bit of a sort of, you know, surely it's a fantasy, and it's the sort of thing you see in Lord of the Rings, isn't it? And it's all very dubious and dodgy. Is this not just a fabrication that later generations are sort of, you know, trying to get authority, invoke an authority for stuff that they've made up? And it has to be said that some Tibetans themselves have doubts about the terma tradition. The fact is, the terma tradition is extraordinarily rich and important, not just spiritually, but culturally as well. The text, the literature, even some of the found objects, is truly vast and staggering. And clearly, judging by the translations of some of this literature, it's the product of extraordinary inspiration and profound spiritual insight. Whatever the origins of these terma texts are, they are really very, very profound expressions of the Dharma. The terma tradition is a kind of manifestation of Buddhism's, the Dharma's tendency to always renew and refresh itself, and to communicate in the present, in the time and place in which it exists, in which it operates. Guru Padmasambhava himself said in a Atharva text, the guru of times past is not the guru of future men. The guru of the future, the teacher of the future, the teaching of the future will differ from the teaching and the teacher of the past. The essential Buddhist principles will be the same, but we will need to find a creative application for the situation we are actually in, not in a facile, superficial way, but in a way which derives from the depths, the heights of spiritual practice and spiritual insight. Remember, the Tirtan goes down into the ground to find the treasure, or up onto the mountain peak. He finds the treasure in the depths of mind, in the vastness of transcendental space, to draw forth the teaching for his time and his place and his region. So, the Tibetan Book of the Dead was discovered in the 14th century in the region of Dakpo in southern Tibet, found on the Gampo Dar Mountains, found on a peak that's like a dancing god. The cache that was found there precipitated the emergence of the cycle we call the Tibetan Book of the Dead, was found by one Rigdzin Karma Lingpa. And this was found and written down and transmitted when he was just 15 years of age. So we're dealing with a young spiritual genius. He was the son of a Nyingma Lama, came from a Nyingma family. And Karma Lingpa taught the text, the prophecies in the Terma, the treasure that was found, said, you instructed clearly, you only teach this to one or two people. So he communicated it to a small number of people, and it was handed on from teacher to disciple for three generations after, just to one or two people. So it was the preserve of a very small group of people, this Tibetan Book of the Dead. Karma Lingpa actually died very young, and very little is actually known about him. Eventually, the cycle became very popular among the Nyingma and Karma Kagyu schools of Tibetan Buddhism, and it's widely used by those traditions at the time of death, widely taught in particular as a guide for the dead. In the 20s, this text, or part of this text, just one part of it, was translated by a Sikkimese lama named Kazi Dawa Sundup, and the text was, this translation was edited by W.Y. Evans Wentz and published as the Tibetan Book of the Dead in imitation of the previously published Egyptian Book of the Dead. In a way, it's a bit misleading, this title, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's used by some Tibetans, but followers of other schools follow other traditions of death and dying. So we mustn't think of it as the authoritative Tibetan book about what happens after death, and definitely not the Buddhist Bible of death. Other Buddhist traditions have other ways of thinking about death, approaching death, and have other notions about what happens after death. Whatever, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is a brilliant synthesis of Buddhist teachings on death, especially from the point of view of the Tantra, the Vajrayana, the Great Perfection, which are the traditions followed especially by the Nyingma. But the book, the teachings, are firmly based on the teachings of the historical Buddha, especially the teachings of all-pervading impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, insubstantiality, of the need for liberation from the perilous and painful cycle of birth and death, of the necessity of such practices as renunciation, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, study of the Dharma, meditation, gaining insight into the true nature of things, and the constant cultivation of mindfulness, love, compassion, faith and devotion. All those classic Buddhist themes and practices are explicit and implicit throughout the Bardo Tadol, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So the text that we're just going to take a few themes from is a tradition that emanates from the great guru Padmasambhava, communicated originally in the 8th century, which was rediscovered by the great treasure finder Rigtsin Karmalimpa. This text that, through the strange turns of history, has become quite well known in the West. There's been a number of different translations, and books like Togyal Rinpoche's very famous and much loved Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. And a few weeks ago, a new translation of the whole cycle of texts discovered and promulgated by Karmalimpa was published, beautifully translated by Guillaume Dorje, and very well reviewed in the national press and on the radio and things like that. It's great hearing one of the arts programmes talking about the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Most important of all, Western Buddhists have found the text a great source of inspiration and support in their lives, especially during times of loss and bereavement. They found the text that it really was something substantial they could turn to give them some orientation at that difficult time, something that would help them to relate to death in a way that could actually help them and help their loved one at the time of death, after death. And I know people have used the Bardo Tadol, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I can assure you it's been very real for them. It's not been a way of sort of hiding from reality, a sort of consoling fiction, but a way of relating to death and the loved one who has died in the most positive and meaningful of contexts. I think this is very significant. In the West, in the modern West, which is fast becoming the condition of the whole world, we tend to keep death hidden. We try to tidy it up, try to make it disrupt our lives as little as possible so that we can get on with life. In traditional cultures, of course, this isn't the case. If someone dies, if a family member dies, the extended family, the friends in the village or in the area, not only conduct the after-death and funeral rites, but they have a proper period of mourning, a proper period to see the loved one to the world beyond, however that is envisioned. I remember in India, very popular practice among Indian Buddhists following Theravadin tradition is the Punyana Modana ceremony, which takes place about a month after someone's death. And it's a really lovely ceremony. You're invited to the house of the person who's died. You're given a lovely meal, of course, and you do puja for the loved one, and you rejoice in their merits, and you transfer the merits to them, and it's a really lovely occasion. Yes, it's a bit somber still, but you remember the person who's died in a very positive context. The Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Tadol, the great liberation through hearing in the Bardo, is read to the dead, for the dead, 49 days after the person has died. The tradition is that the consciousness is in this intermediate state for 49 days after cremation, or sky burial, as they call it, the Tibetans, where the body's just left for the animals to devour. And I think these periods of, as it were, mourning, if that's the right word, or remembrance, I think there's something to do with the rhythms, if you like, of the soul, to use a rather un-Buddhist term, the rhythms of consciousness. And this was really brought home to me after my father's death. When my father died, I loved my father very, very deeply, still do. But I was quite surprised. Yes, I was upset, I cried, I grieved, but I wasn't sort of, as it were, overwhelmed by that. But what I found was I just could not relate to things. It was as if something didn't work. My faculties couldn't work in relation to really quite ordinary things. It was a mist, if you like, between me and the world around me. I was kind of interned and preoccupied. And I was talking to a very good friend of mine about it. I said I was really sort of puzzled, a kind of inertia as well. And he said, I really relate to this idea in traditional cultures of, you know, a period where you kind of observe, you're with the person on their journey after death. And he said, maybe that's what you're doing. Maybe in a way you are with your father on his journey. And that was the only thing that really fitted, you know, my experience. I had lots of dreams about my father after he died. After about 6 or 8 weeks after he died, I had a very powerful dream indeed. And it was a dream of a stag man. A man with a stag's head, with you know, great antlers, great horns. He kind of just appeared walking towards me. And I woke up with a feeling of kind of purification and liberation. No idea where this image came from, apart from my unconscious. And I told a friend who's into sort of pagan mysteries, that sort of thing. And she told me that, well, this sounds like Cernunnos. It sounds like Cernunnos, the horned god, the old pagan god. And she said among his associations is that he's a guide of the spirits after death. He takes the spirits to the lands of eternal summer. Who knows? Something seemed to kind of complete something with that dream. Our relation to death is... we have a relation to death, whether we know it or not. On some level, we are deeply aware of death, and we need to make that more conscious. We need to bring it into the light. We need to establish a creative relationship to it. Death is part of the fabric of life. Life, in fact, is just constant. Birth and death and birth again. Life is just a continuous rising and passing away. We become very aware of this now in the depths of winter, with the long dark nights, with the bare trees, with everything kind of rotting down. Go up into the woods up there, go out into the reserve and just see it rotting down. It's fantastic. It's just so wonderful, this dying process. Everything just rotting away, you know, into mud and, oh, it's gorgeous up there. Stand in the dying of the light beside the rotting reeds and remind yourself that this is part and parcel of your living, of your life, this dying away. So we need to pay attention to the constant arising and ceasing of all things. We tend to think of death as being sort of an add-on at the end of life. But that's not the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha teaches that life and death are both constants in all experience, in every moment. In articulating and expressing the deep, the inconceivable nature of reality, the Buddha spoke of it as a constant flow of ever-changing conditions, a constant flow of ever-changing, impermanent conditions, continually arising and passing away, continually arising and ceasing, a coming into being, a going out of being, a living and dying, and a living again. Nothing is exempt from this. There's nothing that is fixed and unchanging, no permanent self that kind of goes through it all, no person in that sense, but internally and externally an arising and ceasing, a thought, a feeling, a mood, even a complex mood. Watch your mind. See how it arises and passes away. Watch your breath, the coming and the going of the breath. Feel the coming and going, as it were, of the heartbeat. Observe the seasons, the living and dying and living again of the seasons. Look at civilizations, religions, arising and passing away. Consider your own life. Childhood, youth, manhood, old age, death, and, according to Buddhist tradition, being born again. Arising and ceasing, and arising and ceasing. In later Buddhist tradition, this is spoken of as well as the, as it were, union of form and emptiness, of appearance and emptiness. Things appear, they arise, but you can't grasp them because they're already fading away. This vision of existence, of all existence, actually gives to Buddhism an extraordinarily positive vision of life, actually. It could sound, in a way, depressing, but it's not. It actually gives Buddhism an extraordinarily positive and deeply optimistic vision of life. It's very easy to think of life, of our own life, as being rigid and incredibly defined. The tracks are laid down by our conditioning, our social conditioning, karmic conditioning, whatever. But Buddhism says no, that it's not just defined. It's not fated to be a certain way. Because of this continuous arising and seeing, this ceasing, this continuous living and dying, there are always gaps and spaces and openings where we can step into something different, where we can take a sort of revolutionary step, change the entire course of our life. And these spaces, these gaps, these openings are bardos. Bardo is a Tibetan term that literally means between two. So in between or intermediate. The enlightened man, or the man well on the way to enlightenment, always dwells in the awareness of this space, this openness. He dwells in continuous awareness of appearance and emptiness. The great yogi Milarepa sings in one of his songs of always dwelling in the bardo of awareness and emptiness, of appearance and emptiness. And when you see his life, read his life, hear his songs, read his life story, it's just filled with inspiration and bliss. There's just this unfolding creative experience all the time and fearless activity for the benefit of others. We, of course, don't dwell in the bardo of appearance and emptiness. We still see things in terms of fixed and solid blocks. So we need to be made aware of particular points, particular places where we can be more aware of bardo. Those moments, those times in life where a cycle ends and a space opens up, where we can see more clearly, more keenly, ceasing and arising. In that space, in that moment, there's the possibility of making a break with imprisoning and habitual responses. There's a possibility of developing, moving towards liberating responses. There's a possibility even of complete liberation. So these are the bardos. So just say here, for within the FWBO, the word bardo has sort of entered the language. You sometimes talk to somebody and say, yeah, I'm in a bit of a bardo at the moment. And when you actually go into it with them, actually what they're really saying, I'm a bit stuck. I'm in a sort of limbo. That is not bardo. In the Bardo Tadol, the bardo is described as a narrow, perilous pathway. Something opens, but it's not an incredibly wide opening, and it doesn't stay open for very long. And it's perilous because you can lose the opportunity, you can squander the opportunity for liberation. So bardo isn't about sort of hanging around in a rather sort of dull, spaced out sort of way and dignifying that with some Buddhist language. Bardo actually seems more like a crucial situation, more like an existential space. A space in which, yes, there is an opening of possibility, of potential, but only if you make the right choices. So let's look at some of the bardos. The bardos that are listed by the Nyingma tradition of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the bardos from the teachings of Padmasambhava and Karmalimpa, they follow, in fact, an ancient Indian Buddhist tradition of Antara Bhava. Bardo is a translation of the Sanskrit Antara Bhava. Antara means inner or inside or in between. Bhava means existence. So it's the in-between existence. So there are six bardos that are listed. First of all, there's the bardo of life. Our life is a bardo. We are now in a bardo between taking birth and dying. For Tibetan Buddhism, for Buddhism generally, our life presents a great opportunity. In Buddhist literature generally, there are many reflections and meditations given to gain a deep appreciation of this life and its potentiality. Human life, human consciousness, human awareness is very, very special. We have this remarkable thing, this awareness that can actually reflect on experience. We're not just completely locked into our senses. We can actually reflect on what's going on, so we can learn from our experience. We can see that our actions have consequences. We can see the effects of how we live. We can also, because of this quality of awareness, identify with others through reason, through imagination. We can identify with how others see the world, so we can develop empathy and love. Our awareness can also intuit, as it were, out of itself, spiritual, transcendental ideals and principles, can intuit enlightenment itself, the ideal, the principle of wisdom and compassion. And we can take up the necessary course of training, of practice, to actualize those ideals and principles. And in the root verse devoted to the Bardo of Life, we are urged in particular to listen to, in other words, to study the Dharma, the Buddha's teachings, to reflect on those teachings very deeply, to meditate on those teachings, to make them a living experience. We're urged to see all experience, external appearances, and the mind itself as being without any fixed and unchanging essence. See it all as a sort of magical display, infinitely malleable and changeable, so wide open with possibility. If we live like this, we can gain enlightenment, the totality of enlightenment. Enlightenment in body, speech and mind through attaining what are called the three bodies of the Buddha, the Trikaya. We can do all this in the Bardo of Life. But the verse warns us, don't be idle. Don't waste your time. Don't squander the wealth of this precious human existence. Like other Bardos, life is actually a very narrow pathway. Life, after all, is very uncertain. Health is very uncertain. The time of death is uncertain. Life, actually, in the general scheme of things, doesn't last very long. So make the most of your life. Don't squander this very precious opportunity. Don't come to the end of your days and start, you know, kind of moaning that you haven't really lived how you wanted to. Really decide how you're going to live now, because we don't have the time to waste. Secondly, there's the Bardo of Dream. So Bardo, a dream is a Bardo. Dream is a space, an opening. Dream is the intermediate state between two waking states. In the dream state, because of the suspension of the senses, because of the withdrawal of the senses, and even, as it were, the kind of falling away of volition, one can, according to traditions of the Bardo, glimpse the clear light of reality itself. And one is urged in the Bardo verse, the root verse, to rest in that naturally. In dreams, you can have profound spiritual experiences and insights. You can have those big dreams, those wonderful archetypal dreams. If you practice deeply and continuously, awareness starts to carry over through into the dream state. And you can even start working in that more malleable world. You can see Buddhas, decide to see Buddhas and receive teachings, even attain enlightenment in the dream. Dreams, of course, can be very real and very vivid. You can have those dreams where you're being chased, you know, by terrible people who are going to do terrible things to you. And you wake up and you think, oh, it's only a dream. Phew. Or wonderful dreams, blissful dreams, where you're, I don't know, walking in a wonderful landscape and it's just so perfect and wonderful, and there's a beautiful woman or a beautiful man come to that, and you're just about to consummate and you wake up and think, oh, it's only a dream. Damn. In this way, the dream state can be a sort of metaphor for the nature of waking life. Buddhist tradition likens life generally to a dream. Actually, everything is like a dream. It arises and passes away. However intense the experience, it passes, becomes memory. It's very hard to distinguish sometimes, you know, our memories of waking life and memories of dreams. There's not really a lot of difference between them as memories. Then again, how do we know that we're not dreaming now? How do we actually know we're not going to wake up in a moment? It's a bit of a freaky thought, but we don't know. So we're instructed by the tradition to view life as a dream, so that we don't cling to it, get attached to it, get stuck in it. But the wonderful thing about this teaching don't take sleep and dream for granted. They're a wonderful part of life. Enter into them creatively. Thirdly, there's the bardo of meditation. Meditation is a bardo. It's a space, a potentially creative space. In deep meditation, especially the mind, the heart, is malleable and flexible. It can take new directions. It just doesn't have to follow the old, tired habits, generating mindfulness and awareness and loving kindness through our meditations. You develop that more malleable mind. When you meditate as well, you can start experience, as you get more concentrated, more integrated, an incredible sense of expansion. Habitual thoughts really do cease and fall away. Thoughts and their associated feelings and moods, they just drop away. Thoughts about the past, the present, the future, just drop away. And some texts even talk about entering a sort of fourth time, a boundless awareness beyond the usual way of thinking about time. You're sort of out of time, in a pure and total presence. This sort of space will only really open up if we work and practice, not just on the cushion, but with our ethics as well. And when we actually meditate, and the Bardo verse really brings this home, don't fall under those things that make you just space out and get distracted. In the Tibetan tradition as well, the Tantric tradition, they also have, and this is referred to in the verse that I'm going to visualize, you have two particular stages of meditation, the stages of visualization and the stage of completion, or the perfected stage. What this is referring to is the fact that in some meditations you're instructed to visualize various symbols and images expressive of your deepest spiritual ideals. You see them as made of light, like rainbows. You meditate on them, you go through an incredible sort of drama, as it were, with them, but then you dissolve them away into the space, into emptiness, into the void. And the Bardo Tado often reminds the dead person, see these images as insubstantial. See them as arising and passing away. So it's using the imagination to meditate on insubstantiality, arising and ceasing, arising and ceasing. When you meditate like this, you start to see life more like this. Fourthly, there's the bardo of the moment of death. The moment of death is a creative space. And the Bardo Tado describes the dying process. It describes the fading away of the senses, the dissolving, the dissolution of the elements, the parting from the body composed of flesh and blood. That time will come. That is an ever-present possibility. And at that time, the Bardo Tado teaches, the clear light of reality itself shines forth. The luminosity of emptiness shines forth brilliantly. In this shining forth, there is no self, no other, no subject, no object. The ground has gone completely, just a blinding, overwhelming brilliance. If you've trained, if you've practiced, if you've meditated on this light in this life, you recognize this light as the light of awareness itself, and you transfer to it directly. Enlightenment is attained at the moment of death, in the bardo of the moment of death. Most people can't take it. They fall away very quickly, frightened. They fall into a swoon, and they come to in the next bardo, the bardo of dharmata, the bardo of realityness, the bardo of the way things are-ness, the bardo of dharma-ness. Here, that light of reality, that undifferentiated luminosity, takes form as images and symbols of enlightenment, and images and symbols of the world, the wheel of life. The bardo of dharmata is an imaginal world, by an imaginal world I don't mean fancy and fantasy, but what we have here are the imaginal in the sense of showings of reality as it is. What you see will be the deep images that are within you. And for the Nyingma Tibetan Buddhists, these are Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in peaceful and even in wrathful forms, terrifying forms, as well as strange hybrid animal-headed deities, kind of chthonic images from the depths of the Indo-Tibetan unconscious. If you've trained in meditation on these symbols, on these images, if you've led a spiritual life, you can respond creatively to the images that arise. If you're drawn towards the habits, the mental poisons, you fall back on the mental poisons of craving and hatred and envy and conceit and deep delusion and ignorance, and you're drawn towards the images of the wheel of life and the whole cycle of birth and death. You're instructed in the Bardo Tadol to recognize all these images as the display of mind, and to respond to these brilliant lights coming from the Buddhas as wisdom. So this raises, of course, the issue of the imagination, which is a very big topic. I've said that I'm not talking here about fantasy, escapism, daydreaming, which is so pervasive nowadays in our TVs, in our cinemas, on our computers, in our books. I'm talking about imagination as an absolutely basic human function. We actually live from images and symbols and myths. We actually do. And we need to make all that conscious and uncover, find the images that expressed the most deepest meaning, that lead us to the deepest meaning. In Buddhist art, the icons, the tankas, these paintings, they're not illustrations of the way things are. They're really more like gateways to reality, to dharmata. Again, this bardo is narrow and perilous, and we're faced with choices, and most people fall away and go on to the next bardo. We're going to be spending most of our time, at least in imagination, in the bardo of dharmata throughout the rest of the retreat. We're going to be looking at some of the symbols that arise in that. Sixthly, there's the bardo of taking birth, or the bardo of rebirth, the bardo of re-becoming, because it's very important to realise that the being, to use that word, going through this whole process never stays the same. They're a stream of consciousness. There's no thing, as it were, going through it. That's only a manner of speaking. And in this bardo of taking rebirth, we're in a mind-made body, a body made by mind, and we find ourselves in fearful landscapes, in dense fogs. We find ourselves on terrible precipices, looking down into terrible voids. We're driven on by black winds and rain and sleet, and we're chased by hordes of violent people who are shouting, "Slay! Kill!" They really want to do us in. The atmosphere is terrifying. And all this is you. So what the Bardo Todol says, all this is you. These are your habitual, unskillful tendencies, just driving you along to be born again. And of course, you are looking for safety. You look in, you know, sort of mean hovels, holes in the ground. They look very attractive compared to the threat that's all around you, anywhere, just to get away from it. But the reader, the Lama reading from the Bardo Todol, tells you, don't go there. Don't go to those mean little places. They might look safe, but you could end up in a terrible, painful rebirth. See all this as emptiness. See all this as insubstantial. It's just mind. Eventually, if you don't see through it all, you see a man and woman having sex. They're making intense and passionate love. If you have intense attraction for the woman and intense jealousy towards the man, you're going to be reborn as a man. If you have intense attraction to the man and jealousy to the woman, you're going to be reborn as a woman. This is what the tradition says. And even here you can do something. You're told, you're instructed by the Bardo Todol to see this man and woman in union as no other than Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of great compassion, in union with his wisdom consort. Or you see your teacher, your spiritual friend, in union with his wisdom consort. But for goodness sake, don't go there. See them as the deity. But if you don't pay heed, you try to get between them. And eventually you swoon, you enter the womb, and you're eventually born, and the bardo of life begins again. So these are the six bardos. The last three bardos are the particular concern of the Bardo Todol, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's really a manual for the dead, and it's read to them so that they will make the right choices, even gain enlightenment. So it's the Bardo Todol, the great liberation through hearing in the bardo. It's really an extraordinary text, and I'd recommend that you read it. And it comes from an extraordinary vision of life. Padmadaka was saying in our community meeting last week, they said, well, even if you don't sort of believe it, as it were, and it does make you think about death a lot. It does turn your mind to death, at least that. But the vision of life it's coming from is of tremendous potential and possibility. At the same time, it's full of gritty realism. We have the potential for great things. We have the potential for enlightenment. We have extraordinary potential. Our awareness gives us so much possibility. But there are no guarantees. If we give in to our mental poison, we squander our potential. It's as simple as that. And the Bardo Todol is all about making those choices. So from all this, I think you can start to appreciate that this idea, this notion of bardo, is not just, needn't just be concerned with these six states. Bardo, I think, is really any situation where the ground goes, where the habitual is disrupted and the space opens up and there's the possibility of living differently, of responding to truth, to reality, to enlightenment. That space might be opened up, perhaps, through bereavement, through loss. It might arise out of your human maturity. It might arise through a brush you have with death. It might arise out of the unfolding of your Buddhist practice. It might even arise in really profound, very, very deep communication, where you're sort of led, as it were, to the edge of yourself. That bardo might even open up during a retreat, as I said last night. Buddhist practice is about training for these openings, noticing these openings, developing the awareness of these openings and responding to them creatively, entering them with energy and pure love and mindfulness and confidence, responding to the luminous light path of reality.